Welcome back to another episode of the Rough Cut Club, where we talk all things art and business of filmmaking for freelance creatives just like yourself. Really excited today to talk to a chief lighting technician and gaffer by the name of Julian White, who has been a gaffer for 27 years and worked on numerous projects that you have definitely watched. Was a really, really interesting episode today.
Man, unpacking different fixtures, how lighting has changed in the last 27 years. And bro, you just got to enjoy the accent this
you
guy's
do,
got.
You do, man. He's all the way from the UK. All the way from the UK. I like that. But man, he just did a really great job kind of bringing back some ideas that are really great to have on the forefront, just in terms of like, creating broad strokes, but still trying to simplify the equation at the end of the day. And this is a really great reminder for me, especially as you know, working with me all the time, to sometimes it's better to simplify the setups.
He was listening. He was like, join us as we jump into this episode. Great for DPs, great for gaffers,
absolutely.
Great for anybody in the freelance world. Let's get started.
Let's jump in. I feel like one of the things that I hear the most when talking to other cinematographers or other filmmakers is that they love filming, but they wish they were better at lighting. And today we have somebody who has put in way more than their 10,000 hours to become an expert in the arena of lighting. He is a chief lighting technician with over 80 IMDb credits, working on projects like The Martian, Cinderella, and even Game of Thrones. Welcoming to the show our newest Rough Cut Club member, Mr. Julian White. Julian, welcome to the show, man.
Good evening. How are you? Well, good evening here.
Yeah, good evening over there. What you said? It's 8 p.m. What's the time difference? We got like a 5 or 6 hour time difference right now over there.
And where are you exactly, Julian? Are you in what part of England are you in?
I'm in my studio in Northwest London, but I live in the center of London.
Amazing.
Awesome.
Amazing. Well, we have seen you online, man. You're literally connected with Masterclass and you put out tons of information out there for the public to learn and grow in the arena of lighting. And as a DP myself, when I stumbled across your work and your page, I was like, man, this guy gets it. Like, he has done a lot of projects, and I'm excited to jump into just your wealth of information, your knowledge, and just kind of pouring back into our audience as well, man. To kick this thing off, tell me a little bit about where your journey as a CLT, a chief lighting technician, began, and what kind of brought interest to you in that world.
Well, I guess I started like when I was 30, so 27 years ago. I didn't anticipate being a gaffer. I didn't anticipate. I kind of wanted to be in the film industry, I guess. I'd done some props and different things in, you know, TV shows and things like that. I didn't really enjoy it. So I'd kind of left the industry without any intention, then came back and I entered it. And then I was at the right age and I had a artistic background. So I just kind of slotted in, but I didn't come from a technical side of it. I didn't come from a construction side. I just came from I kind of wandered into a room, I guess, a little bit. And it was like, it was cool. It was good. It was nice. And I was like, oh, this is okay. You know, it's better than working part time, and I was painting, but not earning enough money, and the balance changed. So it was good. And I enjoy filmmaking. I think it's a really interesting process. And it's a military operation. It's a group of people who come together, not military operation literally, but it has its same kind of core elements, I think. And, it's quite a fascinating place to be, and you travel and things like that. So, which I've always liked. So yeah, I traveled when I was a kid a lot. So
that's awesome. I love your, I love this story. I feel like a lot of us, we've talked to a lot of people on the show, and a lot of people have said we kind of all stumbled into this world. And so it's interesting to continue hearing that, you know, that trope play out in other filmmakers alike. And so,
artistic, they were all making it, and you know, was it faking it till we make it kind of.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. We, even just on the last one, they were talking about, I still have, what was he saying?
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Like, right. A lot of us still going through imposter syndrome and just faking it till we make it.
Yeah. Now, Julian, did you say that you were painting before that? Did I hear that? Right.
Yeah, I, Yeah, like when I was 14, I started painting and I really enjoyed it. And I used to live in a quite a boring part of England, and I was kind of like, I used to go out painting and I really liked it. And then, I don't know, art really clicked for me. And then I went to art college, and then I stopped painting, ironically. And then I started picking up video cameras and stuff like that with a friend of mine. And we started making some cool stuff, actually, some interesting, you know, just we didn't have a clue. So we didn't have anything to lose, you know. So we just messed around with stuff, edited it together. It was old style. It was good. And then I was always kind of not shy of technical stuff. I think that's the thing. I get it, but I don't want to get into it. You know, I'm not into taking and getting into the nitty gritty electronics of things, but I like, you know, I enjoy the technical side of it as well.
That's awesome. Do you think painting at all influenced your, I mean, cause I you know, and I'm not, I drew a bit. I don't think I ever got past, I don't even think I got to watercolor. I think I was like charcoal, you know, pencil, that kind of thing. But, so very amateur, but I assume when you get into painting and that you're really working with light as well, right? You're kind of shaping the light and did you say that have a big influence in your gaffer career as well? Or maybe a foundation.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But also the process of it as well. There's a certain discipline about making art that you have to follow as well. So it was, in many ways, more than just the visual side of it. Yeah, for sure. But I think also we look in painting, you look at tone much more rather than color. Mm. Not always, but in the sense of when you're doing, you know, composition and stuff like that, it's much more about being tonal. And I think everything's very color saturated now, so it's kind of distracting a little bit. I think that's the difference with painters. I think you look at things tonally first when you start drawing and stuff like that. You definitely look at things tonally.
Sorry, you brought up the word process, and I'm curious to know how you go about, taking a project at the early stages of its development and bringing it to its final stages. When a new project hits your desk, what does it look like for you to work with the director or the DP to kind of come up with a vision for how you want to tackle and light a project?
Yeah, I think it's like anything. It's a bit like, maybe somebody gives you a menu and it inspires an appetite in you, if you know what I mean. I don't work too closely with the director. It's more through the director of photography to the director, but depending on what project it is, you know. But I'm always kind of, as soon as you read the script, you kind of start formulating your idea of what it would look like. And then obviously the group assembles around your idea. So then, obviously production designers have an opinion of director of photography, et cetera, et cetera. There's an artist's rendering of what it should look like. And then you have to so kind of meld your idea of it into that. And hopefully it constructs together well, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But it's kind of an interesting process. It's kind of, you start with just something on a page. And then things start formulating and people start building things and models get made and you start meeting the actors and all kind of things. And it's a construction. So it's like reverse sculpture in a way. If you know what I mean? It's kind of
process. That's so good, man. I'm curious, when you get onto a set, do you feel like you bring like a specific mindset to like most projects where you have goals that you kind of keep more in the forefront of your mind? I listened to one of your interviews and you were talking about, you really lean into keeping things looking as natural as possible, or just a minute ago, you said you feel like people often, things are more saturated than they should be. Do you feel like you have a mindset or a framework that you operate within, that is like standard across most projects that you work in?
Listen, I think it's like doing anything. Is if you're a chef, you do the same thing. You have your parameters, taste, values, but then you get surprised by things. So I bring a mindset to it. My thing is always try and be as simple as possible. And why over-gild the lily? You know, if it looks good, then leave it. There's a certain tradition in filmmaking where we have to control everything. And there's a kind of nice quality about letting go a little bit as well and absorb, you know, reading the room, I guess. Yeah, I think, you know, it's like cooking. You have an idea of what you want. There's a flavor, there's a taste, then you get an appetite, and then it builds and builds, and then you start going, well, you know, what have we got? Do we have to go shopping? All those things, factors come in, and then when you start actually preparing the food and cutting it, then you get more, you know, of course, you get close to eating. And as you get to the first day of filming, it's like, right, we're ready to eat. And it's kind of that thing. It builds not in a very straight way. It's a lot of information being layered up, you know, through the process.
I love it, man.
And also sometimes it's where you don't, you know, the bits that you put up but don't use, in the sense of you edit on the day. It's your decisions are being, they're being worked with a cinematographer, but also you make decisions as well, which can, you know, affect a lot of things in the movie as well.
Hmm. Yeah, man, I love that so much. When I was doing my my research on you prior to this episode, I came across two quotes that I wanted to kind of dive in and see if you could expand on for me. But you said, being a gaffer is a bit like being a race car driver. You don't need to know how to fix the car. You need to know how to drive it. You can be qualified to the hilt and have no real understanding about why you are doing it. Can you expand on what you meant when you said that?
Well, I think, you know, the thing is that it's like, as a guy, you know, or anybody who's a technician on the front line of around the camera, you are a bit like a Formula One team. You know, you have that kind of, there's an atmosphere about it, being quick, efficient. Obviously, you know, we have a process of working, et cetera, et cetera. But being a gaffer is, it's like as a racing driver, you're in the front bit hurtling forward, I guess, and it's, you're relying on the mechanics and engineers and things like that. So you don't have to, I think knowing how the car comes apart will help you to a certain extent, but your job essentially is to race that machine around the track as fast as possible to win. So you don't have to really bother yourself with all that stuff, because actually it might not help you drive. The thing that you have to do is deal with the cockpit and how the car feels, and feed back that to the engineers, which then comes back to you as, you know, a better process, or you as you then become the winning team, as it were. So it's kind of like because you are going fast, you don't want too much. You have to find that sweet spot between speed and functionality, I guess. You know, but I also think that a lot of manufacturers, for instance, put stuff on lights, for instance, which as a racing driver, you'd be like, I don't need that. You can take it away, but, you know, obviously you can't have everything your way, as it were. So
that's great, man. You had another one that I wanted to dive into, and it says, all DPs will appreciate their gaffer making their process as easy as possible so they can concentrate on talking with the director and thinking creatively. The least you can do is be a facilitator and a collaborator too. So how does that play? Like, talk to me a little bit about just that quote and how you approach being a collaborator within the process.
Well, I think, you know, the collaboration things, it's a bit like, it's one of those, because at the end of the day, a DP is a boss and you're really facilitating what he wants, and you can bring creative input. But it's at the very least, you know, if you removed it, you're still doing your job, if you see what I mean. So you're kind of giving it as a bonus. And as if you naturally want to be creative, then of course it goes, you know, he gets extra, and you want to make it efficient so that, be like a surgeon, you want to be standing there with the right instruments at the right time. He doesn't want to be going scalpel, and you're like, scalpel, I didn't, you know, you have to have that preparation, but you also have to make then choices of how you work it, you know, how you practically run that system and light with it. And because I'm a creative person, I'm always going to have an appreciation, also a comment probably about, well, maybe this should be like this or maybe like that. I think sometimes a DOP doesn't want that, actually, that they just, it confuses them more. And some people really do. So it's fine. Like any relationship, they're like, you know, dude, just put the lights up and then I'll worry about the other stuff. And they, you know, which is fine, but it's, for me, it's not, I don't then partake, you know, I'm like, just like, yeah, here's the scalpel, here's, you know, and it kind of, then you become a mechanic, and that doesn't really interest me completely, you know, there's part of it, but I want to be able to have to influence color, contrast, you know, or throw up things that a cinematographer might go, oh, I really like that. And then you get a collaboration because you're offering things that they like the taste of, and then you get a symbiotic thing. And with some cinematographers, that's really a nice place to be, you know, because you're working at your bit, you're giving your creativity, and they're allowing you to influence in without an ego thing, but also then it helps them as well, because while they are talking to the director and dealing with all that stuff, you can be presenting the dish, as it were. So
I feel like some of my favorite gaffers that I have worked with, I've told them the ones that can do two things for me. One, the ones that can anticipate my needs become really valuable to me, because they can then take pressure off of me in that process. Knowing, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna need a floppy like on standby as a courtesy when we're outside, you know what I mean? It's already built and anticipated, or I'm going to need, you know, extra fill, extra bounce, whatever it is. The ones that can anticipate my needs become really valuable. And then the ones that collaborate with me in an artistic way where, they're that extra voice in the room that says, hey, I'm looking at the monitor the entire time, that I'm not working on a new light, and I'm bringing, you know, I'm helping mold the scene with you. That collaborative process to me is always some of the most valuable gaffers that I enjoy working with, as a DP.
Yeah. No, and it makes the, you know, if you are going to go on a journey with them, so it's going to be, you know, a rough, smooth thing. It's not going to be easy, but if you can be partaking that and be acknowledged for that, that's, you know, good praise.
Do you have a specific project in your career that you feel like you're most proud of?
Yeah, I mean, I like, you know, The Martian, I really thought it was great, and a lot of people comment how great it was. Mike Control was always a film that I really liked doing because it was at the right time in my career, and it connected me to something quite important, I think, which was, you know, a group of people, which, you know, Control was a very low budget movie, and I still see the same people through my career and work with them occasionally as well, and it's quite nice. And it's a tough shoot. It was 6 day weeks, very hot, you know, but it was part of, I think, pop history in a way and pop culture.
Yeah. The Martian was a film that, that I really loved. I've watched it multiple times and, really, really loved just the story in it, the acting. And, I mean, the lighting was insane, you know, just trying to create literally another world, and make it look realistic and believable. It was, very impressive. What was your experience like working on The Martian? And then what did you learn, while being on that set?
Oh, I just learned big movie making in that sense. You're just like, you know, I'd been on big set, I'd been Cinderella and stuff like that, but I kind of, and Ridley's got a cachet, you know, he comes with it. He's a imperious figure, you know, and he's very talented, et cetera, et cetera. And Darius Volsky as well. So I was a bit, but because it landed quite quickly, I didn't really have much time to think. So I kind of entered into it. I'd never done a space science fiction movie, but again, there's a certain machine, which is quite nice. That's the thing about Ridley's films. There's a certain machine. They kind of have this way of, you know, there's big departments moving in unison, and it's not always easy, but The Martian was, it was good fun, actually. It was cold. It was Hungary in the winter. So it was good to go out of space. Then we went to Wadi Rum as well in Jordan, which was interesting. But no, it's a great experience. But also watching Ridley do big broad strokes. He's very good at, you know, he would be like a Dutch master. He would just go, wow, there's just kind of these really amazing cinematic movies and done really, you know, shoots 4 cameras sometimes or every day. And it's like, that's crazy.
Wow.
You know, because he storyboards it as well. And Ridley's the other thing, interesting. He comes from a fine art background, and he was a artistic director for TV in England for many years, and then became, you know, director. But he's got a very good eye, and he does all his own storyboards, so he has it all formulated in his mind, and he kind of just puts it into place with his group of people who he, you know, works and trusts with and has a good relationship for a long time. And I think you can see it. It's kind of quite an amazing experience, actually.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I know the broad strokes conversation is an interesting one, because so often I feel like in the indie space and sphere, you have to get really granular a lot of times with, you know, certain setups and how you light and move throughout a scene. But when you make it to these bigger worlds, the mastering the broad strokes, if you will, becomes really challenging and really shows the mastery of people within their individual roles.
I think that's something I learned at the beginning of my career when I went on Band of Brothers, and they had these massive cranes with Wendy lights on it, 120, whatever it is, 32 kilowatt lights, which they'd walk, you know, move around like toys almost. And you're like that going, oh, right. And that takes this long and you can do this and that. And a bit like Ridley's film, I'd stepped up a level and just gone, oh, this is kind of a, you know, it's a very good working machine. You know, it works very well. It's an operation. And Ridley does, just because he doesn't think about, you know, he thinks about the money side of it, but can make decisions which are quite big about we're going to go here, we're going to go there, et cetera, et cetera. And you kind of just think, well, that's a man of his age as well, 86 now, but just, you know, keeps on going with that kind of, the canvas is huge.
I watched Dune recently again, and it just reinvigorated like the idea of doing the broader strokes as a DP and everything, because so much of those worlds, the shots aren't complicated, but they're all masterpieces in and of themselves a lot of times, with just how they lit everything and designed the world and, yeah. and the lighting and the feel of it. And so I love that. I also
it's
would be,
finding that.
Go ahead.
No, sorry. I was going to say it's finding that line between something being constructed. It's too big, but it feels like it's, you know, heavy and turgid, and then keeping it light. There's a sweet spot between the two, and that's the art of it, I think, is broad strokes, but with a light feeling. And it's difficult, you know.
Absolutely. You also did multiple episodes on Game of Thrones, correct?
Yeah, Game of Thrones was a weird experience for me, actually. I enjoyed it. But I got zero prep. I kind of arrived on a Friday and started on a Monday.
Wow.
So I was like, oh my word. Because what happened, what happened, David Benioff and David Weiss, is it? I can't remember the name. Anyway, the producers, they create so much visual effects that they had sort of overspilt what they were shooting. So they've created another unit, which was called the White Walker unit. And I didn't watch Game of Thrones, so I had no clue what I was getting into. I knew it was a big thing. But I turned out and I was just like, wow. And they were just going, oh, if this is character, I knew no characters. I knew no, you know, locations or sets or anything. And I just was like, oh, my Lord. And this is a team that was left by the other gaffer who left, you know, which is always kind of a bit weird. But I enjoyed it. It was kind of, rough. It was a lot of mud in there. No shoots. Not for me. Definitely, but you certainly see it all the time. Cold.
Cold.
have you since watched the entire series?
No, I watched the seasons I did. But I did really weird things. Like I was there standing next to Jon Snow when he woke up, and everybody was like, and I was like, I had no idea what was going on. Another thing, I was working, you know, and I went into the Hodor set. Do you know the set, which is like all underground? And
yeah.
There's Max von Sydow, who's like a legend of movies, sitting in this chair surrounded by all these branches and stuff, underlit, top lit with a 20K, and I was just like, oh hi. I was trying to stick a little LED eye light in there, and it was such a weird surreal experience of seeing Max von Sydow, just, you know, kind of. I said, oh, I didn't expect to see you here. And he kind of goes, no, I didn't expect to be here. He said, but the money was good.
That's awesome, man. Game of Thrones was a favorite of mine all the way up until about the last three or four episodes. But I really liked the series up until then, so I didn't know if you had an opinion on it.
No, I've at the end not going, damn. I was just like, well, but it's an interesting experience working on something which everybody has such a thing about,
right,
that you know nothing about. You know, I do move soccer. With these huge soccer players, and it was like, oh my God, and I'm like, I don't really know who they are. I don't follow teams, you know.
That is funny.
That's funny. They're like, that's Jon Snow.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was a really good experience on Game of Thrones.
That's awesome, man. Go ahead.
I'm curious, going back to Joey asking about one of the most memorable sets, what's one of the most complicated? I mean, I imagine The Martian with, you know, lighting those big atmosphere, you know, scenes. But what was one of the most complicated setup lighting, you know, schematics, setups that you've had to do in your career?
The ballroom in Cinderella was quite a thing, because we had all the lights we had created. We basically created long tubes of tungsten lighting. So we had these things called, I've forgotten what they're called, actually. Maybe it'll come to me. But they're pre-rigged truss. And they come and they have park hands in, so you have 16 kilowatts per truss, and you join them together, and then you put them on a rotating on hoist, so you can rotate them backwards and forwards as if you're doing just rolling a big pin.
Wow.
So we put them all around the set, so we could turn them into top light, back light, like the architecture. So we had this whole system. But of course, you have a map there with 120 motors on, and you know, it's a big 200 foot wide by 300 foot set with loads of people over underneath you, and it's kind of a, sometimes you just go, oof, that was a busy day. And you have to, eventually you start memorizing which numbers are which, and then you can, you know, it works easier. But it's a busy day. But that was complex. We had 100 and whatever, 200 dancers. They'd all rehearsed. You don't want to screw it up, you know. So it was kind of, there's always a little bit of pressure. And also the thing is that you make, the other thing about the Ridley experience was that you make calls about quite a big thing 2 or 3 months before. And that's the broad strokes thing, is that you know you'll need certain things. So you put those in place, and then you, the rest is kind of additional. Mm. You, as you get closer to the project, then you can refine it. But if you don't have it in the first place, so it's working out the big picture first and then working smaller and smaller and smaller, and doing the detail last, obviously. But, you know, so with Cinderella, it's kind of like there's a huge construction going on. You've got, again, fit in there. They've got their own deadlines, their requirements. You know, Dante Ferretti was the production designer who was, you know, one of the biggest in the world. And you kind of have to deal with all the daily going on of all that, you know. It's quite busy. Mm. And that you're not, you know, an imposter.
Mm.
You know, it's a bit like that. Yes, I concur. I absolutely concur, 100%.
That's awesome, man. The way that lighting has changed has been pretty rapid in the last like 5 years, especially. Definitely 10, but I mean, really to get hyper focused in the last 5 years, all of the new fixtures that are coming out in the LED space are, there's just been a lot of really quick evolution. Is there anything that you would say is like a big, like having done this for 27 years, is there anything that you would say is like a big pet peeve of yours for the way things that are commonly done nowadays, instead of maybe like the right way to do them in your eyes?
Yeah, but that's because I've done it another way. I think, you know, eventually maybe there's a bit of cynicism or jealousy or whatever those things, but it's when you start working with tungsten lighting, it's a different feel to it. But that's
right,
a slightly romantic thing, a pain in the ass as well, you know. So it's lovely to be able to tweak it, or just, hey, do that, and he goes on his iPad, which is great. But there's also a certain lack of, you know, robustness about it. So it kind of gets, and I think everybody gets a bit tech obsessed, actually.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is that everybody, Brian, is more, I'm like, just, I need 6 buttons, you know, up, down, left, right. It's not, don't complicate it. Mm. And I think as soon as anybody gets a light out, we have to go, oh, what, you know, does it work on this? Does it work on that? And I'm like, well, you could actually just walk to it and change it. But of course, as soon as you have the ability to control everything, and you start controlling everything. And I don't think necessarily, it's not a terrible thing, obviously, but it can be, lose a certain quality, I think.
On the flip side of that, how would you say that all of the evolution in the last several years has changed the way that you work within a set?
Well, there's, again, it's that refinement thing. As you get closer into the camera or into this, you know, the detail, you've got much more refinement. Like moonlight has changed as hugely with LED, because you can get the broad, soft, low level lighting, you know, and it's changed a lot of things. But also in that, I think when you get around camera, you can hide stuff. You can, you know, put stuff where you never used to be able to as well. And because it's getting smaller, it's battery operated, Wi-Fi, you know, it's all. My only thing is that how far can that go? I think there's a limit, and I think we might have reached it, you know. Mm. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to be, you know, I want the lamp to be more Wi-Fi. I don't get, you know, they'll be like, what do you mean more Wi-Fi? Well, it has to be faster. And I'm like,
right.
You know, I don't want to wear an Apple TV. I just, it's not, a millisecond's not. So, you know, how many more colors can we have? Mm. So we're already promising 600 million, and it's kind of, or whatever it is, but, you know, how... So I think it has to go back the other way a little bit, which I think it will.
When you say you think it'll go back the other way, what do you mean by that?
The people will like when it's less is more, that they only have 4 buttons, because actually choice is not great things when you're in a hurry. You know, if you have loads of programming time, you can, of course, refine it much earlier. But at the end of the day, when you're trying to do stuff, it's kind of, you know, when it's too many, you're relying on too many things apart from a switch, as it were, or a dimmer. And now it's kind of, so it dislocates you a little bit.
Do you have an opinion on HMIs versus LEDs? I've heard a lot of DPs and gaffers debate, well, HMIs were better, and but they're also more of a pain. LEDs are easier, but they're not quite as,
yeah, and I
you
think
know.
That, you know, it's like, and you get to know your instrument, and if it works and you suffer the pain of an HMI or suffer the pain of an LED, it's, again, it's a thing, a taste thing, I think. Yeah, I mean, HMIs are less and less now. You know, they're the big boys, but you don't, you know, the around camera, there's very few. But there's a certain look to them. I think the electronic look, and I think HMIs have less electronic look. But yeah, I think your palette changes as well. I think you can grow. I didn't like fluorescent when I first started working. I found it all, like, it left an aftertaste in your mouth. It didn't kind of, it's quite metallic. And so you disguise it a little bit with muslin or something like that. But then HMIs have the same thing. You have to kind of deflect them a little bit. They're not as, they're a bit too electronic. And LEDs, I think, sit somewhere in the middle, I guess. So I think we, as technicians, we're always concerned about it. But then actually you talk to people who, you know, your wife or friend or whatever, and they go, nah, it's like, it tastes the same. It's kind of, but it's about, you know, of course it matters, but it's about how far you want to go with the minutiae of any electron.
Right. One of the things that, it's funny because as experts, you try to master the nuance of your craft. And so often the nuance will go unnoticed by 99% of people. But it's the 1% that gets focused on when you're trying to hone in on what you're doing.
I got kind of a silly question for both of you. And I'm a, director, producer by trade. And I don't, you know, I did a little bit of DP work. So this, maybe I will both say this is a ridiculous question, but do y'all have a favorite Kelvin, a color, temperature for light?
I was going to do a thing. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I don't think I have a favorite Kelvin. I will say that depending on the camera that I use, I have found that tungsten reads different from an accuracy standpoint than daylight does. And I have found that daylight is easier, in my opinion, to get more colors that are true to the color that you're actually shooting rather than tungsten. For whatever reason, that has been my experience with the cameras that I have used. But I don't know. Would you have an opinion on it?
No, I don't know specifically, but I know what you mean. It's kind of like the warmer colors don't quite register properly.
Yeah.
There's something about them. And it's also low level light as well, which doesn't help.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I've really, and you know, I have Sony cameras, but Sony is really, really amazing from a technical standpoint. But I have found that especially shooting in tungsten lighting with Sony cameras, their colors are not accurately reflective of what they look like to the human eye. But I have found that when I go into daylight, I feel like the color fidelity gets higher. And now there are certain cameras that are better than others. You know, you start working with certain Alexas and, you know, I mean, Blackmagic is honestly really, really great, at color fidelity and whatnot. But I have found that daylight, I get more true to the actual scene that I'm shooting.
Okay. So.
You'd be specific though with Kelvin. What Kelvin?
Well, that's true. 5600 is not true daylight, but it is where I typically let my daylight live. Or I will, okay. I will err on the side of 6,000. So I would say anywhere from 5600 or 6,000 Kelvin.
I think six is right. Not
wrong.
I'm just saying, like the extra twist of lemon or something, you just feel it a bit sharper.
That's right.
I like it. See, and I had to ask y'all this because, so, you know, at my house, my wife and I, you know, we argue about the lighting color, you know, and she likes incandescent 32, you know, warm, soft light. And I'm like, no, blast it with some daylight. I want it, you know, bright. And, but, you know, but she's right. Yeah. It is 32 Kelvin
at our house. I will say inside my home, I prefer tungsten lighting.
Okay.
Inside the home.
Me too. Indoors, you know. And I think that's a nostalgic thing because I think that's, you know, comes from, it's a warm candlelight show, you know, and it's, because you go into some places and they have fluorescent strips and I'm like, how do you live in there?
Right.
Fluorescent strip lighting. Daylight bulbs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm a fan of
tungsten. I was going to do an experiment. I did like a masterclass at one of the film colleges in London is to get, I didn't do it in the end, but to get a light and just say to everybody what Kelvin, put it at a Kelvin and then ask them why you put it at a Kelvin. You know, I'm just curious to see whether people went for daylight, tungsten, didn't care, just span it and had a go, you know. Go, well, why did you pick that? You know, I don't know. Because mine would always be 4,000, I think, weirdly, because it's somewhere in the middle, I guess. But it's kind of, it's not my taste of choice, but it's the starting point, you know.
I love it, man. is that, do you have someone who you feel like has really been a big inspiration to you and your work?
As an electrician, I mean, gaffers or?
Yeah, as a gaffer.
Well, the thing is, you don't spend much time with other gaffers on the thing, but I always kind of admire people's, they kind of, the scale of things sometimes, you know, when I first worked on Band of Brothers, there was a very nice gaffer called Jim Wilson. And if you met him, you wouldn't, you know, he was kind of just a big smiley, happy guy and very talented and just very sweet. And he was the kind, because he was a human being, I think, and he just treated everybody quite kindly and nicely and did his job on a big scale. And it was quite impressive. And I was probably, because I was young, overawed and like, but I always followed him as a person who's, you know, very genuine. Because the industry can be full of, it's like the carnies, you know, it's a lot of mix of characters you have to meet. And it's, you know, it's interesting.
For somebody who's out there and they're aspiring gaffer, what is one piece of advice that you would give them to be successful in today's day and age?
Well, I guess a lot of people say politics, you know, staying close to the politics of who, obviously whoever controls, if it's a financial thing, it's whoever controls the money. And if it's creative, whoever controls the, that creative process. But it's also, I think it's an odd relationship in a way, isn't it? It's kind of like you have to, because at the end of the day, you could just turn up and say, what do you want to do? And I'll do it, and have no real bond between that person and you. There's no kind of, reciprocal acknowledgement that you're, you know, part of that group, that part of that process, that you're just kind of there as a person to do their bidding. So it's, that relationship is quite difficult. So it's, you know, as a, you have to sort of get to, for me, it was certainly dealing with the character, the bigger politics, the on-set politics, and then that. So my thing is always keep an eye on that always, because that's, that relationship with the DOP is very important. And if you want to continue with them, as they grow, you grow. But it's a circuitous route, so it's not always that you'll do movie after movie with them, but you'll know them along the way. And just understand, I'm always curious to say, you know, what do you like doing? You know, what's your other interest to inform me about who you are, that I would then have a way of relating to you and therefore developing a partnership creatively. So it's those things. But that's, as a, you know, apart from all the technical knowledge and the understanding, you need the experience of being on set with people, and then you build things together, and then your career moves on to the next thing with bigger people, et cetera, et cetera. So
walk me through, you know, when you jumped into the industry and you kind of got that first exposure to it, like fast forward to today, what were some of the big key things that helped you continue to advance along your journey? Or was there any big, you'd mentioned one project, but was there a big project that you feel like really helped unlock connections that helped to build your career on? Was it just brick by brick you went along, or what were some of those big things that really... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Cinderella was obviously a big Disney film, so that kind of puts you on the map. And then, but it's again continuing that thing. And I worked with Harris Ambulux and Kenneth Branagh for a long time. And we did like 5-6 films together. I think it's like planetary stuff. You know, it's like you go around to a bigger planet and you get slingshot around it. And then you go, you know, things, you maneuver, not maneuver, but you're maneuvered around things by accident or incident, people you know, or phone calls you get, you know. And but I think, again, like The Martian, doing that, it was like, oh, I've entered into another world, you know, another room in that big mansion of filmmaking. And then you also, there's that thing of being connected to other people through history of filmmaking as well. You know, I'd worked with like Peter O'Toole, who was a, you know, my father's loved him and et cetera. And then you finally work with him and you kind of go, and my father's passed away, unfortunately, but that you have that, like, oh, there's a connection to your own history through that, you know. So I've forgotten your original question now. I just went off.
Well, I was just wondering about how you, like, was there really a big moment for you that helped kind of build the foundation? You said Cinderella was pretty impactful.
No, well, I think, like, that's what I'm saying, is that you come together, you work around a force of gravity, which is the movie and the director and all the actors, of course, so there's interest, all those things. And then that swings onto something else. But so there's not one part of that. You just suddenly feel like, oh, I've just done a film with Ridley Scott and Matt Damon and Darius Volsky. And, you know, and you kind of go, oh, that was, you know, I guess everybody is like, oh, I survived. But also, did you feel like you did a good job? And then you know, you hopefully somebody calls for another one. But it's, I think that bigger industry world as well, they move country to country, so you're not always guaranteed that the next one will be in your country as well. Mm. You know, it's a big traveling circus, I guess. No, Game of Thrones is whenever I meet people, they always want to talk about that because it's the most interesting. It's got the, seems to have the hugest fan following, and I'm always like, yeah, it was quite an interesting. So, like, I was talking to you about the interesting project, you know, of having to deal with all that.
I'm curious to know what was your very first picture that you worked on, you know, as a lighting technician, gaffer? Like, what was that very first brick, that very first step into the industry?
I did a film called Dirty British Boys, and it was like about Pakistani gangsters in middle England. And it never got finished, as far as I know. It had money problems and all that. And it was an interesting project, but it was the first. And I had literally, it was like jumping into a pool unknown. You know, I just didn't know what I was getting into. So I had nothing to lose. So I went, and it was a very low budget. So anyway, but it was very interesting. And it taught me a lot about, you know, getting to know people, being with a lot of people in under stress situations. But then the other film that really kind of, when I started really thinking, oh, I'm actually lighting, is because I was an electrician on that one and not gaffer, but it was a film called Beginner's Luck. And it was like it's a really interesting project actually about this group of artists trying to put on low budget traveling theater in England. And it's very kind of very quite English, I guess, but it had that kind of feel of, you know, good comedy in that era 20 years ago, 25 years ago. And that was quite because we went to Paris, you know, it was all kind of me in a transit van and occasional people coming in and out. But again, it was a very good experience, you know, and the irony of it was beginner's luck, I guess. It was kind of like, oh, I had nothing. Because beginner's luck is when you don't have anything to lose and you're like, yeah, I can do downhill racing, no problemo. Pull it off, and everyone's like, wow.
You had mentioned working on low budget projects, you know, especially early on. What are your thoughts on how long you should take those low budget projects and kind of what they, you know,
it's like an abusive relationship. You have to just say, well, how much, you know, this certain part of it works, but the rest is very difficult. So you just have to draw your line and be proud of it. And actually, I think when you draw the line, you start getting paid work, ironically, because your name gets passed around. You know, oh, this guy will do it. He's got a van. And then everyone's like, and nobody really wants to say no. So they're like, yeah, I'll do it. And then you're like, oh.
Yeah, well, I think there's value. Like you said, it's like the abusive relationship. But I think there's value in doing the lower budget projects when you're building your infrastructure, or if it's going to connect you with a big opportunity for you to either learn or build relationships.
Absolutely. But the thing is, I think when you get in, that's a long-term thing in the sense of wherever you go, but you have to at some point saying, well, I'm worth this much money. Absolutely. Not its union or anything, but this I put on it, and you start meeting, but then you just get into a higher budget, lower budget world. It's not like, it never seems to end, you know, because if you're doing, I'm sure Ridley's going, oh, I need more money because I need to do that scene, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all a relative perspective, I guess.
Sure.
And also the thing is that actually, if you took away low budget movies, you wouldn't have half the films that we all love. You know,
that's right.
People, when I, but it's not a big movie. And I'm like, well, what's your favorite film? And if it was Jaws or Star Wars or, you know, Blade Runner, even, they're not big budget films. They weren't like, these were, Ridley was going right under the radar. You know, he was like, I'm going to make my movie. And they were investigating him and stuff like that. So it wasn't kind of, you know, all easy peasy lemon squeezy Marvel. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of not an industry in that sense. It's and I love that. That's the thing. People getting excited about movie making and then making really good stories. And because you haven't got money, you have to be really inventive. And actually, that's where most interesting things really are. You know, that where they come from is when you have to be inventive. And that's true to music, cooking, people, relationships, education, everything. Is when you have to start using your intelligence, then it gets better.
When an indie filmmaker is it investing in a self-owned or a owner-operated kit, if you will, are there any must-have lights that would be in your kit or that you would recommend an owner-operator bringing into their kit?
Well, again, it's scale, isn't it? It depends how big you're going. I would always, you know, have stuff. My thing is to have one light that does three things, you know, and there's a lot of that modular lighting, as it were, in the sense of that everybody goes, oh, this is good. But I'm like, yeah, but it weighs 50 kilos and it's on a stand. I can't break it down any further. So, you know, again, I'm not suggesting going big, buying big lights, but if you can get three lights that make a bigger one, then, you know, go for that. And then you can always, then you have three lights and you can do three key lighting. And if you just need a big, broad, soft light, you've got that. So it's always not a specific fixture or a specific style. It's just saying, if you can have, you know, three LED panels, which make a fourth one, in the sense of one, the third big one is really good. So you can then, because everybody goes, oh, I've got the big one. And I'm like, yeah, but then I can't reduce. So it's kind of, you know, in a kitchen, for instance, you probably have three knives. You have the ones you always use and they're kind of, but it's just finding your style of lighting. And I always recommend getting a boom, obviously, because you want to get light behind people. And if you haven't got much money, a good boom is always worth the investment, I think. Or just this, you know, selections of stands and all that stuff. You don't need much. And again, just keeping it simple, I think, is always a better way. But I, you know, when I, for instance, if I'm asked to gaffer a short film, and I did one with Ray Fiennes recently where they said, we haven't got much money. And I said, well, just give me the budget and I'll work out the lighting. And I did exactly the right amount of lights, but then I put them up. So of course they're the exactly right amount of lights, but the DOP was never like, oh, I need more. It was just, it worked very well because I was given control of the style, if you know what I mean. And I'm not blowing my own trumpet in that sense. That's the efficiency thing, you know, keeping it as simple as possible.
That's good, man. Looking like at, you know, some of the advancements that were made with lighting in the last several years, kind of like we discussed, is there anything that you're most excited about looking forward into the future of where the lighting industry is headed?
Yeah, I think projected light is the thing, to be honest. That's the thing that will be the go-to, because you know light traveling through space with projection is the thing that we lack most in film lighting, and that's why the HMI still exists and so does big tungsten, because we haven't got that big source yet, and it is coming, but it's just there's a lot of, it's almost like trying to put the genie back in the bottle. They've got all this heat they're trying to force into a small space, which has to be dissipated, and of course it destroys itself. It's kind of one of those weird ironies. So until that comes along, we're, you know, it's going to get better, but, or different, should we say. But I think light going through lenses for me is always the thing. It's like if it's traveling through glass, then it does things to the light, which is more interesting rather than just, I'm not into big soft panel lights, you know. Because I can soften a hard light, but I can't harden a soft light. And I want to see its travel and then all the things that it does on the way before it gets there. And do you know what I mean? It's kind of like a soft light just fits you into one piece of thing, whereas a good hard light is having the sun, I guess.
That's awesome, man. One of the things that was big for me was having a light powerful enough to do, like you said, multiple things with. And, you know, having a hard light that you can make soft is, for me, one of the things that it's a must-have with me when I'm on set, rather than just having the single soft source, even though soft is normally, not always, but normally.
Hard lighting is very hard to do as well. It's, and with all due respect, it's in the sense of that people do like soft, but I think it's an easier thing because it's, you know, it's counterintuitive to use hard lighting. But, you know, I love those kind of when it hits stone or wood and stuff like that, and you get these beautiful bounces and then you soften out the hard bit more just locally. And then it's got this kind of, it just kind of wraps around things, you know. The thing that Bob Richland actually, I love, he would do, he'd have an 18K Arimax outside the window and then a frame with some festoon lights. So you get like a daisy chain of tungsten bulbs through white cloth or unbleached motion. That would be his fill light and that'd be his key light. And he'd just bounce it into the wall, full spot. And it kind of was like, it's just simple, you know, that's two things going on. And it's things that I just thought that, but how you can really, you know, spot it in and you concentrate the light into a specific point does very different things. But yeah, soft light is always been the thing of, I think it makes people look more beautiful because it wraps around their skin and all that kind of stuff. So
when you say hard light is harder to do, what approach do you typically bring when needing to add hard light to a scene, or what helps you do it well since it is harder to do?
I think it's like anything. You put in you do something and then you taste it and does it make it better? So you just sort of smudge it a little bit. I guess you control it. You net it down in certain bits. Again, shaking it up, just panning it around and seeing what it's doing, whether it's hitting probably hitting the back of the set wall and bouncing in quite nicely, you know. But it's like, I think there's the hard light. It's, well, I think that what I was going to say earlier is that, of course, you want the range of taste. So you want soft to hard, and then one informs the other. So like, if you put salt on chocolate, it makes it sweeter. It kind of, it's balancing those things out. And so some people avoid hard light because it's quite difficult, especially on faces. It's like, oh, what are you doing? You know, and again, two things we did in The Martian, we used hard light because it was Mars. So there was no kind of warmth, diffusion, you know, in the sense. So it had to be hard light. And then on in Cinderella, we used hard light on slightly diffused, but hard light on Cate Blanchett. But again, a beautiful woman in beautiful costume with beautiful makeup on 35 mil, you know, beautiful color. Fully saturated, it just looks amazing. But so the hard light, it could have been soft, but it just did a different thing. It just, the image is a very different, it doesn't wrap so much, it kind of gets in, cuts in a little bit. But that was because we used as a reference George Harrell from the 1930s and 40s Hollywood. He used to do that, would be like Marlena Dietrich would just have a big hard key light or above her face. And just losing the nose shadow, and it does everything, all the eyes, et cetera, et cetera. And they got good skin, it looks great. But people don't, you know, except in fashion shoots, I don't really do that in film. They're always like soft, 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 soft. Which I, you know, it's good, but I think I want a bit of salt with my chocolate occasionally.
I like it too, man. Well, Julian, this has been great, man. I always love getting to pick the brains of people that do similar things to me and just gain insight into how they do them differently from me or the same and reaffirm certain things. But it's been great to kind of dive into how you approach the process. We got three questions we like to ask every guest before we wrap them out of here, man. If you could go back in time in your career, what is one thing that you would do differently?
Probably invest my money better. or see the bigger picture. It's, well, not that like every time you finish a movie, you're like, you know, you have to, because you work very hard. And of course, when you finish, you enjoy the benefits of that. But of course, with all those things that have, the strikes and things like that have gone on, it's been, you know, you kind of go, oh, maybe when I was younger, I should have said, you know, I'll put it in whatever. It's just, I'm joking really, but it's kind of like the one thing that in the industry is always difficult is finding the rhythm of the movies, you know, that you can't jump from film. Film, or you don't have the opportunity and things come along and change, but it's finding the longer rhythm. So I would just say, you know, don't be in such a hurry, maybe just enjoy it a bit more.
That's good. What is one piece of advice you can give to filmmakers trying to grow in their craft or their business?
Ask yourself the question, I guess, is the thing, is have an intelligent conversation with yourself. If it feels good for you and it encourages you and engenders something in you, then carry on. But it's kind of like there's no... what I would say is there's no easy jump up. A lot of it's just luck. People you know, obviously, but it's just be patient, I guess, and it'll get there. And just you keep honing your craft, because every time you do something, switching a light off or on, you know, is your palate, is your tasting, and it's a long journey. Because, of course, when you're in your 30s, you're like, I want to... But if you get to the summit too quickly, you know, you have to... There's a long journey ahead, as it were. So don't rush.
Who is one filmmaker who has inspired you or your work?
The person I called Alan J. Pakula, who did a lot of movies in the 70s in America with Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman and was just a very intelligent, and his movies have, you see the intelligence in it, and I always admired it. And I always thought, if he was alive, they look great as well, but if he was alive, because he worked with Gordon Willis, et cetera, et cetera. And if he was alive, it'd be like really interesting to work with him. And there's a very good documentary, because he died in a weird freak accident in a car, and everybody's just devastated by his, because he was such a lovely person and intelligent and considerate and all those things. I'm sure he had his things, but and his films are intelligent. They come over as being a good process, you know, well thought out. Highly recommended, all of them.
That's good, man. Yeah, I always like when I hear an answer that I haven't heard before, so I'll have to.
I'm gonna have to look that up. I want to see the documentary as well.
That's, I know, great. Yeah. This is kind of a bonus question I've been throwing in at the end, but in no specific order, can you give me like three of your favorite movies of all time?
Godfather 2, I think, actually would jump straight out, because I do think it's a brilliant film. Lawrence of Arabia, in a way, because of sentimental reasons, because of Peter O'Toole. But it's my father, and it's a brilliant film, and it's got that again. that's Ridley, you know, it's big scale, Chris Nolan, kind of like, we're going to the place, you know. There's a film called The Sweet Smell of Success with Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster, and it's shot by a Japanese-American cinematographer called James Wong Howe.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a really good... My dad really liked it, but it's a really good black and white film noir, you know, it's great. Great sound, great acting, you know, beautifully lit. Simple.
Awesome, man. Well, Julian, you have taught me a thing or two on this interview already, and I'm sure that somebody listening has learned from this. So we appreciate you and your time, man. Hopefully you get to go to NAB. I don't know if you will or not, but hopefully we'll get to connect at NAB sometime, some way in the future.
For the northwestern part of Scotland.
Well, maybe another year, my friend, maybe another year, but we appreciate you just donating some time, man.
Pleasure.
Really quickly, for those that want to get connected to you, what's the best way for someone to get in touch?
Instagram, bloodandlight66.
Love it, man. Well, thank you once again, man, for joining us, and we appreciate you just giving us some time. Thank you guys for listening to us on this episode, and we'll see you next time on the Rough Cut Club.